You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, October 21st, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live depths from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Brian Fallon, co-founder, executive director from Demand Justice. On the Supreme Court, yesterday, today, and tomorrow, metaphorically. Meanwhile, parents of nearly 550 immigrant children kidnapped by U.S. Customs officers cannot be located. And as hospitalizations increase in 37 states, the coronavirus pandemic has caused 300,000 excess deaths this year so far. Mitch McConnell increasingly concerned that Nancy Pelosi in the White House may strike a coronavirus stimulus or relief deal. Meanwhile, the White House wants to cut coronavirus and other health service funds to Democratic-led cities, so-called anarchist cities. Betsy DeVos says the Department of Education has no role in tracking coronavirus in schools. The OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma will plead guilty to three criminal charges. Amy Coney Barrett apparently was a trustee at a school that barred children of gay parents, as well as discouraging LGBTQ teachers. Texas can reject ballots for non-matching signatures with no review process. Alarm bells ringing over Karl Rove's White House push to fast-track a 5G spectrum contract. And lastly, half of Trump supporters think top Democrats are, of course, involved in a major child sex trafficking ring. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. We are now less than 2 weeks out from the election day, as we have been calling it for years. However, of course, people are voting now. We have record numbers of early voting that is happening across the country in varying states. Really impossible to know whether these are indications of increased turnout. We will have higher numbers of people who will actually be participating in this election, or it's we have higher numbers of people who are participating in this election early. In other words, these are people who would have voted on election day in a normal year, but because of coronavirus and mail-in balloting and concerns about people's ballots being counted, they're voting early. So we really can't know. There are, you know, hints and shades here and there, but nothing that is particularly definitive. You know, people are looking at the genders of ballots that are coming in. 2018, we saw a surge of women in coming out and voting for Democrats. So if you see a similar, I guess, increase in women's ballots coming in, that may be indicative of a big Democratic win 2 weeks from now, or whenever we find out what the results are. We could find out the results in 2 weeks from yesterday. We could find out the results days later, weeks later. We shall see. There's also things like there's some polling that we've been seeing, or I should say reading about, that not really available to the public, but on a district level, I think Greg Sargent did an interview with a pollster about that in the Washington Post. And on the district level, where you can see more granular breakdowns of who's coming out to vote, the district level polling, specific districts around the country, look good for Democrats. But again, it's really difficult to tell. It's really difficult to tell. So folks should get out and vote and have patience. I feel like we're all sitting around with bated breath on some level, but what can you do? Meanwhile, Donald Trump is has been on tour, as you know. He went to Pennsylvania, which is going to be a key state. It is a it is one that Hillary Clinton lost by 40,000 votes or so in 2016. And it is one that there are ways of Joe Biden winning if he doesn't take Pennsylvania, but it gets a little bit complicated. And this Pennsylvania is going to get a lot of attention. I think former President Obama is going to be visiting Pennsylvania soon. Here is Donald Trump in Erie, Pennsylvania. I'm not sure this is the best pitch for Erie, Pennsylvania, but here it is.
4 or 5 months ago when we started this whole thing, because, you know, before the plague came in, I had it made. I wasn't coming to Erie. I mean, I have to be honest. There's no way I was coming. I didn't have to. I would have called you and said, hey, Erie, you know, if you have a chance, get out. But we had this thing won. We were so far up. We had the greatest economy ever, greatest jobs, greatest everything. And then we got hit with the plague. And I had to go back to work. Hello, Erie. May I please have your vote? Right? I love Erie. No, hey, we had a big deal in Erie. We had a big deal in Erie, right? This was not supposed to be a Trump thing. It's a lot of Democrats, but the Democrats that love Trump, because I love them. And you know what? You're workers. You're like, we work. We work. We work. But that was a pretty big upset, wasn't it, huh?
He's a little bit lost. I mean, there is a quality of a road comic where it's like, ugh, I can't believe I'm in this dump. Where I remember stand-ups going into like Chinese restaurants that they had built a stage to do some comedy. And the first thing they do is they spend the first 5 minutes dumping on the place. I don't know. Maybe that'll be effective. The audience didn't seem to be terribly excited at the fact that he really didn't want to be there.
Trump also made an early exit. I don't know if that's a common thing with road comics either, but he complained about the weather being too cold. It was 50 degrees.
And so he left the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. He also walked out of this Leslie Stahl interview. Do we know what question she asked that got him so upset? Or was he just, was that just like for effect? No idea, right? Is that it?
I think this is a strategy of theirs. Give the media a hard time.
Well, maybe that'll work. Should also, here is, let's talk about for just a moment, Mitch McConnell on the floor of the Senate yesterday. McConnell is, I think, a little bit concerned that the White House is going to capitulate to some of Nancy Pelosi's demands in terms of a coronavirus stimulus or relief bill. It's interesting because we're calling it a relief bill. And of course, if you recall, it's a while back in the wake of the financial crisis, called it a stimulus bill. These are the same things. But one is considered relief, I guess, when you have a Republican president, and when you have a Democratic president, it's stimulus. The idea being that one relieves the pain, the other is it's a proactive government is getting too involved in things. Nevertheless, here is Mitch McConnell saying that there is bipartisan support, but not for things like, oh, support for cities and states and for testing of coronavirus, et cetera, et cetera. He is concerned, I think, that it will put his caucus in a tough position if the White House agrees to, say, a $2 trillion package, because they have been preening about things like the deficit, although they have, of course, been racking up the deficit. And but they also don't want to go out there and vote against helping people. Here's Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor yesterday.
Help, but there's a problem. The PPP has been taken hostage, just like the funding for safe schools, more funding for testing, more funding for vaccines, more funding for federal unemployment benefits, and common sense legal protections that charities and university presidents have been pleading for. The PPP has been taken hostage by Speaker Pelosi and Leader Schumer. The Democratic leaders have spent months holding out for a long, far-left wish list of non-COVID-related priorities and obstructing any additional aid until they get it. All or nothing. All or nothing. That's been their position. Either Democrats get every unrelated policy they want, or American families get nothing. So for months, they blocked bipartisan aid at every single turn. The Democratic leader even tried last night to adjourn the Senate so we could do nothing at all for 3 weeks. Nothing at all for 3 weeks. That's how urgent he thinks it is to help working people. He wanted to go home for 3 weeks. Because President Trump will not just cave to the entire Democratic Party platform, because, for example, the president won't simply hand out endless sums of cash to chronically mismanaged state and city governments out of proportion to COVID needs.
That's McConnell trying to convince Donald Trump that it's in his best interest to deny coronavirus-related aid to potential voters. McConnell's very afraid that Donald Trump's going to realize that he should. I mean, he keeps claiming he's going to go bigger than Nancy Pelosi. He should. He should double it, for that matter. But Mitch McConnell would be terrified if that was to happen. And so that's the pitch there from Mitch McConnell. Don't do anything, Mr. President. Much better to do that. I don't know why he kept saying 3 weeks, too, because I don't think you're going to adjourn for till the election. But I'm not sure what that was about, as opposed to 2 weeks. But I guess it's trying to make it seem like it's much more dramatic. We're going to take just a break here. And then when we come back, we're going to be talking to Brian Fallon, the executive director of Demand Justice, about that concern and about the reasons why Chuck Schumer tried to adjourn the Senate so that hearings, or I should say votes on Amy Coney Barrett, could not take place at least before the election. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member and support the program at jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, you not only support the free show, you get extra content in the fun half, as we call it. And so we appreciate any support you can give the program, jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget to check out the Nomi Key Show. You can find it at youtube.com/the Nomi Key Show. Not sure who's going to be on the program today, but she's been having some great panels as of late. So make sure you check that out. All right. Let's start. We're going to bring a Brian Fallon in. But before we do, let's start with this clip. This is number 13. And maybe we should bring Brian on just so he can see this as well. Let's play this clip, Brendan. Do we have 13?
The Barrett hearing?
Sure, go ahead.
Some progressive groups have spoken out criticizing Senator Feinstein for her handling of the hearings. I was wondering what you make of this criticism and Do you plan to make any changes to the Judiciary Committee?
Okay, I've had a long and serious talk with Senator Feinstein. That's all I'm going to say about it right now.
Can't tell us how that.
Nope.
All right, well, now it's time for us to have a long and serious talk with Brian Fallon. He is the Executive Director of Demand Justice and the co-founder, former Obama administration official. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back on. Nice to be with you.
Now, Brian, I should also say disclosure, and you may not even be aware of this, but Demand Justice did at one point advertise on our audio podcast. So, and I should also say, I think it was just one time. I'm not, that was plenty. But let me also just say, it was one of the rare occasions where I've actually seen like on the list of who's going to advertise and was genuinely excited. I'm a big fan of your organization. And let's, before we get into sort of like what's going on right now, let's just talk a little bit about the genesis of what, Demand Progress is about. Why did you start this organization? What is its purpose?
It was started by myself and my co-founder, Chris Kang. Both Chris and I worked in the Senate for, in my case, 6 years, in his case, seven. I worked for Chuck Schumer as his director of communications. Chris worked for Senator Durbin as his floor guy and chief counsel. We both then went to work in the Obama administration. I worked at DOJ as the director of public affairs. Chris worked as the deputy White House counsel in charge of judicial nominations. And we started this group in 2018 in answer to the Trump-McConnell project of relentlessly confirming these far right-wing, very young, in many cases unqualified for the federal bench, judicial nominees that are going to outlive Trump's time in office by several decades and are going to be an existential threat and barrier to any progressive goals and legislation that we seek to advance in a potential Biden administration and for years beyond that. But we're really trying to tackle something that is sort of a several decades old problem, which is the asymmetry between the far right and the political left in terms of how much it centers and organizes around the courts. The conservatives have for a long time now realized that their overall vision of society is unpopular and hard to win elections by running on, and it's hard to legislate on their agenda. And so they figured out that the courts would be a place where they could do an end run around the duly elected branches of government, so that even if they couldn't repeal ACA through the normal means, even if they couldn't legislate some kind of abortion ban, even if gun safety provisions were highly popular with the public, they could get their way on all those types of issues and more by controlling the courts. And Mitch McConnell has said openly that their goal in confirming so many judicial nominees for Trump is to, quote unquote, move the country to the right. And increasingly, we're seeing that the courts are the vessel by which they not only intend to advance their policy agenda, but also the way that they intend to entrench their own political power in terms of we're seeing a very consistent set of rulings from the Roberts Court in favor of voter suppression schemes that are interfering with the ability to ensure that people can vote during COVID in this election cycle. But, you know, it predates this election cycle. If you go back to Citizens United, if you go back to the Shelby County decision, you know, our point to Democrats is not only is our policy agenda at risk based on these judges that Trump and McConnell are confirming, but our ability to win free and fair elections in the future is fundamentally undermined unless we get in the ballgame and start contesting this battle for the third branch of government. So we're right now in the throes of contesting this Amy Coney Barrett nomination, but we're here for the long haul to try to get progressives to organize around the courts and view that as the political branch it is that needs attention and needs political organizing.
And one of the things that's indicative of that asymmetry was the number of vacancies that were left after the Obama administration. A part of that, obviously, was extreme obstruction by the Republicans in a way that we had never seen before. But part of that was also and correct me if I'm wrong, a failure of the Obama administration to prioritize having, you know, judges there to nominate in a way that the right does. So they just basically have a Gatling gun of judges to put up one after another. And the other was a failure of Democrats in the Senate to understand what really to sort of like appreciate the context of what's going on. I mean, I'm thinking in terms of Pat Leahy and his upholding blue slips, which is now a quaint tradition. But we hear things from Democrats that we're going to bring those back. Like, I mean, I mean, speak to that lack of awareness and then what your organization is doing to counteract that, both in terms of like theorizing a Biden administration and theorizing a Senate controlled by the Democrats.
So you're absolutely right. On the day that Donald Trump was sworn into office, he inherited over 100 vacancies. So part of his ability to set so many records in terms of the sheer number of judges he's confirming is in part because he inherited so many vacancies. The last 2 years of Barack Obama's presidency, he obviously had a Republican Senate led by Mitch McConnell. And so Mitch McConnell deserves a bulk of the blame for so many vacancies being left to Donald Trump to fill, because Mitch McConnell basically did not grant votes for Barack Obama's judicial nominees in the last 2 years. But for the 6 years of Barack Obama's presidency prior to that, before the Senate flipped in 2014, Patrick Leahy was in charge of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And there were a whole bunch of vacancies that lasted for those 6 years because of Senate Democrats' posture, led by Patrick Leahy, that they would only advance Barack Obama's nominees if Senate Republicans went along. And specifically, Patrick Leahy had a vision of this so-called blue slip rule, which is a Senate tradition that Patrick Leahy chose to interpret in its most extreme form, which is to say that if Barack Obama wanted to nominate a judge to a federal appeals court in a particular region that happened to have two Republican senators representing that state, or even just one Republican senator representing that state, Patrick Leahy made it a rule that he would not move that nominee out of committee unless both of those home state senators signed off on the pick. And so even in states where, like Wisconsin, where Tammy Baldwin was there, if Ron Johnson was not going along with the pick as well, Patrick Leahy wouldn't move it. And so as a result, there were all kinds of nominees that Barack Obama put forward that never even got a vote on the Senate floor during the time when Senate Democrats controlled the chamber, because Patrick Leahy was so solicitous of what Republicans wanted for those seats in those states that where they happened to have a Republican senator. Flash forward to 2017, Donald Trump is in the White House, Mitch McConnell's in charge of the Senate. And all of a sudden, they want to fill those very same vacancies that Patrick Leahy was unwilling to fill unless he got, you know, consent from his Republican colleagues. The Republicans decide, screw this. We're not going to let Al Franken in Minnesota have a say over who gets nominated from Minnesota. We want to jam this Federalist Society guy through David Strauss. And it began with nominees in Minnesota and Wisconsin. First, they decided to go against Al Franken's blue slip. Then they went against Tammy Baldwin's blue slip. And then you have the now top Democrat on the committee is Dianne Feinstein. She represents California, obviously. California is at the heart of the Ninth District of the Court of Appeals, which is sort of the liberal, the most progressive circuit court in the United States of America. It's where a lot of challenges to Trump administration policies have been filed because the Ninth Circuit is considered friendlier to issues like LGBTQ equality, immigration policies. There's been three seats out of California on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that if the old rules were in place, Dianne Feinstein should have been able to have a veto over who filled those seats. The Trump administration said, screw you. You are the top Democrat on the committee. We are not even going to show you the least bit of deference on these three seats in California. And Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump jammed through three Federalist Society hardliners over the objection of the soon-to-be Vice President of the United States and the Judiciary Committee senior-most Democrat. And all we've been saying in the aftermath of that to Dianne Feinstein is, hey, they totally disrespected you in this process. They have larded up the judiciary with their people in your own backyard. The least you can do is tell us that if we as progressives work so hard to help flip the Senate and put you in control of this process in 2021 with Joe Biden as president, that you will do unto them what they have done unto us, and that you won't let, say, Ted Cruz have veto power over who Joe Biden can appoint to a federal judge position in Texas. And Dianne Feinstein will not say that. Dianne Feinstein is holding open the possibility of wanting to work across the aisle with Republicans and return to the policy of Patrick Leahy that created all these vacancies for Trump to fill in the first place. It's asinine.
I mean, what? You spent 6 years in the Senate. I mean, this is one of the things I think that people cannot wrap their heads around. It's, you know, I mean, and I don't know if you, the pitch was literally like, hey, they disrespected you. Why are you off? Because it's also like, it's not just really ultimately about disrespecting this one individual. I mean, this is what it seems like the Senate is about, though. It's Patrick Leahy or Dianne Feinstein, or at one point Chris Coons, you know, maybe a year ago was saying like, we should bring back the filibuster for judges if we take the Senate. In other words, we should give the keys back to the Republicans if we own the car, essentially. And it is, they seem to be, I mean, to normal people, to activists, to anybody who's not a senator, it seems insane that this is about like, hey, you know, my colleague at work, like I've decided I'm going to be washing all the coffee mugs for everybody. That's not what's going on here, right? This is like decades of I mean, we could be talking about the destruction of the administrative state. We could be talking about sovereignty over women's bodies. We could be talking about marriage equality. I mean, on and on and on and on. And for them, it is really just a function of like, you know, I decided to give up the first parking spot because I just want to show that I'm a good person here. I mean, that's what it feels like.
I have a friend in the progressive movement named Jeff Hauser, who runs a project called the Revolving Door Project, which tries to advocate against excessive corporate influence in federal appointments. He has a term called learned helplessness.
Yes.
And I think that's just so apt. It's as we have a proclivity on the Democratic side to be constantly prioritizing these very quaint notions of civility and decorum while the other side is obliterating every possible norm. And so we have this asymmetrical warfare being carried out on the floor of the United States Senate. And it was sort of typified again last week at the hearings where, you know, Lindsey Graham, it was outrageous that they were even holding hearings prior to the election to jam this nomination of Amy Coney Barrett through. And there was all kinds of pressure from the outside on Senate Democrats to grind the Senate to a halt, pull out every stop that you can, use every procedural tool in your arsenal to try to slow this process down. And Senate Democrats have been responding to that by saying, like, we are going to do everything we can. You just have to understand that, you know, we have very few, you know, tools at our disposal to actually slow it down. But we're with you 100% in terms of the sentiment. We think this is illegitimate. We want to slow everything down. And then on the last day of the hearing, Senator Feinstein is applauding Lindsey Graham for running such a civil and fair hearing instead of lambasting the process as illegitimate. And so if we can't even be consistent and disciplined, about calling this sham process to jam this nominee through before the election a sham, if we're like giving in to the hostage takers, even in this scenario, which to me, everything's on the line. It's the outpouring of donations after Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, you know, was a reminder of just how intensely personal this fight is for a lot of progressives, that this is the Ruth Bader Ginsburg seat. The Republicans are pulling off their second theft of a Supreme Court seat in 4 years. You would think that if anything could get the passions going, if anything could get the Democrats to meet the moment and play, you know, play for keeps, that this would be the moment. And we still see this instinct to retreat and to turn the other cheek as the Republicans constantly get the better of us. So I think it's a generational thing. I think that there's a lot of Democrats that are newly elected that only know Congress and the Senate as a dysfunctional body, and they want to change things. And some of the folks of an earlier generation that still think that they're operating in the Senate of 30 years ago. So my hope is that in time, some of these younger members that have only known frustration and their time in Washington, that there's a little bit more sense of urgency on their part to change things. And I think that's why there's a bit of a caucus rebellion to oust Dianne Feinstein from that position. You're seeing a lot of junior members talk openly about getting rid of the filibuster. So I think it's somewhat generational. It's just frustrating that it's taking this long.
Right.
Consensus.
I mean, with 6-3, I don't know. Will Democrats be allowed to even have new members of Congress? I'm being a little facetious. But so let me ask you this. I mean, do you think that they should have, or do you think that, I mean, I guess it's a little bit spilt milk at this point to ask whether they should have even attended those hearings, frankly. I certainly at the time thought they should have boycotted. It's very hard to make the argument that this is a sham, but let me participate, because as soon as they do, it seems like every other hearing that has ever happened. And in fact, by the end, it turned out to be one that was, you know, all about Senate comedy. But what do you think? I know you may probably still have some friends in the office, but do you think that Chuck Schumer is doing enough to slow the process? And simultaneously, what do you think about the theory that if there is a cohort of Democrats, it may be generational, that are looking to reform the Supreme Court, whether that involves term limits, whether it involves expanding its size, they would have a better basis in which to do it if the vote on Amy Coney Barrett had to take place after the election when everybody was in lame duck?
So first of all, I don't think it's crying over spilt milk to say that I do think they should have boycotted the hearings. We said that at the time. You know, the senators, and this part is not generational. This was a fairly common sentiment that we encountered as we were trying to propose to them that they boycott the hearings. Even some of the junior members of the committee that are usually pretty good, all thought that there were more points to be scored by confronting her with her record, asking her questions. And, you know, these Supreme Court hearings are a joke in general. Like the by the time they get elevated to the Supreme Court, these nominees are very practiced in the art of studiously avoiding answering any questions. And to be frank, you know, the intellectual caliber of some of these people that get nominated for the court, they're better at evading questions than the senators are at asking them. So I was one of the people that thought that her record was very damning as it was before going into the hearing. There was very little upside to be had by participating in a sham process. And I thought that the air of legitimacy would have completely been taken away if the Democrats just decided en masse that we're not going to participate in the hearings. You've actually seen in some polling since the hearings concluded that support for among rank and file registered Democrats for her nomination is up. Yeah. Because I think amongst people that are only paying casual attention to this, when all the sort of formalities of the process are being carried out, it confers an air of legitimacy on her. And I think that it would have gone over far differently if the Democrats just removed themselves from the process in the way that the Republicans did when they decided that they weren't going to consider the Merrick Garland nomination.
I agree.
I think look to how they handled it 4 years ago to see what playbook we could have carried out this time.
It's a classic case of show, don't tell. If you're all standing outside the committee hearing, nobody has to listen to the words you're saying. They just know that you're not going in there for some reason, and there's a problem. But so. Do you think that there is that Chuck Schumer has arrows in his quiver that he is willing to use, or has he deployed any of those at this point to maybe push the vote? If you, and I'd like your response too to that theory that, you know, doing this in the lame duck increases the outrage that could lead to maybe incentivizing some reform later. Do you think?
I, from the beginning, we have said internally and to other allied organizations and to Senate offices that, like, look, we know that they have the votes, but let's just set a goal for ourselves in the short term of seeing if we can get this past the election, because depending on the results of the election, it may completely change the complexion of this whole thing and their willingness to go forward if they've just lost the 2020 elections might change their outlook. I think that Schumer's, handled this, I think, in an interesting fashion. Schumer personally has actually been quite good, I think. His outreach has been pretty constant to progressive groups. You know, a lot of the big progressive movement organizations have big centers of gravity in New York City. And so if you look at organizations like Center for Popular Democracy, if you look at Indivisible, if you look at Working Families Party, a lot of them are sort of centered in New York City. And over the last 4 years, a lot of their affiliates for those organizations have spent a lot of time protesting outside Chuck Schumer's Park Slope apartment in Brooklyn. And he has taken notice of those groups. I think he's doing weekly calls with all those organizations on a personal basis himself throughout this whole 5 weeks now since RBG passed away. So he's in cycle in 2022. He has seen Elliot Engel lose his seat. He's seen Crowley lose his seat. And I don't think Schumer is in danger of losing statewide in a primary challenge in 2022. But I think he is well aware of the optics of how weak it would make him look if he had a formidable challenger from the left that a lot of these organizations got behind. And so I think being the good politician he is trying to be responsive to those organizations, especially the ones that have a center of gravity in his home state. And so one of the consistent refrains from our coalition, including those groups that I mentioned, has been use every tool in your disposal in the Senate. I think that they are making an honest effort on that. They have done things like invoke the 2-hour rule that shuts down hearings during days when the Senate's in session. They've had motions to adjourn that have failed because McConnell's had the votes. They're doing quorum calls. There's supposed to be one today that requires the Senate to scramble all their members to get so that all the Republicans are on the floor if they want to proceed with Senate business. They did craftily pull off a maneuver where McConnell was sort of caught sleeping and Chuck filed cloture on a bill, which is very rare for anybody other than the majority leader to do, which sucked up 2.5 days voting on an ACA-related measure and put all the Republicans on the record about the ACA lawsuit that Trump's bringing. They've said publicly that they will boycott the markup hearing on Thursday and force the Republicans to either provide a quorum themselves to advance that nomination or change the rules of the committee in order to do so. There's some things that people have asked that that so far they haven't done. Like there was a letter sent yesterday signed by 20 different groups asking Pelosi to send an impeachment resolution on Bill Barr over to the Senate, which would force McConnell to have to consider it. But that's something that would have to originate in the House, and the Senate procedural experts tell us that at most, McConnell would probably only spend one legislative day on that. But if you look at other sort of like what have been like litmus test moments in terms of testing the resolve of the Democrats, one of the other things that we asked of the Democrats was don't take courtesy meetings. One of the usual traditions is that after a nominee is named, they go up to the Hill and they do courtesy meetings where, for 45 minutes to an hour, they talk about their views. And it's a charade where photo ops happen. And that also confers an air of legitimacy. 7 of the 10 Democrats on the committee took meetings with the nominee, which made me want to pull my hair out. Schumer said he wouldn't meet with Amy Coney Barrett, and he's held to that. And then when it comes to the idea of adding seats, Schumer's answer has been probably the best of anyone in the caucus other than Ed Markey. Ed Markey has actually come out and said that he's for adding seats if the Republicans go through this. Schumer has said everything's on the table. And so on most of the questions, I think Schumer, in his personal capacity, has been quite good. Where the frustrations come in is that I think people sometimes hope that Schumer as a leader will sort of drag the caucus along so that it, you know, not just Chuck refusing to meet with the nominee, but Chuck telling the other 46 Democrats to also boycott those meetings. Schumer is not that kind. He doesn't view the minority leader position in that way, in terms of he's frequently will tell outside groups that lobby him that he can control what he does. He can make recommendations to the rest of the caucus, but he can't dictate terms to the rest of the caucus. And so I think that there's still some frustration in some corners of the progressive movement, because a lot of them wish he would be a little bit more heavy-handed, but that's not how he approaches the job.
He would lead a little more. I mean, he's looking at the entire Senate caucus, it seems to me, like the Baileys, his famed family from Long Island. And as long as he provides services for them, he thinks he's doing their job. He's doing his job. But as leader, he's supposed to be basically, you know, whipping people and leading a strategy, as opposed to providing, you know, constituent services for the other senators. And I think that's, you know, as far as I can tell, that's the issue. I mean, I think he's doing a good job of making sure that he remains Senate minority leader and maybe majority leader, and also a senator from New York. But that's not necessarily, sometimes you have to expend some of that capital to be a leader, it seems. And if we needed it, it would be now. So let me ask you this. Let's for a moment assume that the Democrats take the Senate. Joe Biden takes the White House. These are big assumptions. We have a long way to go to get there. But what is happening in terms of, and like, I know that when you guys launched the organization, you talked about having no corporate lawyers as potential judicial nominees for federal judgeships and for Supreme Court justice seats. What is going on now that is analogous to, I guess, the Heritage Foundation giving and the Federalist Society giving Donald Trump a list? Like, to the extent that you can talk about this, because obviously there's a lot of inside stuff that's happening now, how is that going?
So I'd say a few things on that. Our position is that in addition to hopefully expanding the number of judicial seats across the federal judiciary, we'd like to change the sort of paradigm for who a Joe Biden seeks to nominate. And in general, we want those people to be younger than previous appointees of Democratic presidents, and we want them to have different professional backgrounds. We want them to be racially diverse, and diverse from a gender standpoint as well. That goes without saying. But we also want them to bring professional diversity to the table, so that instead of having a default that is set by sort of what would meet with the approval of Senate Republicans, you know, we've become conditioned to nominate people that we think could get 60 votes in the Senate and attract the support of somebody like Lindsey Graham. So who do we typically nominate? We nominate federal prosecutors so that there's a tough law and order image about them. And we nominate corporate lawyers that work for white shoe firms representing big pharma and the energy sector and big banks, so that they're seen as like pro-business Democrats. And we'd like to turn that on its head. And we'd like to attach, you know, some prestige and put a premium on nominating public defenders instead of more prosecutors, and nominating labor lawyers and civil rights lawyers instead of corporate lawyers, and act like those pedigrees are just as distinguished and just as qualified for the bench. So we've been doing a few things on that front. Earlier this year, we worked with Matt Brunig at the People's Policy Project to do a comprehensive analysis of the judicial selection committees that most senators rely on to make recommendations to them for people for open slots in the judiciary. So usually what happens for these judges, it's a very opaque process that is unknown to a lot of rank and file progressive lawyers that might like to be judges but have no idea about how to go about raising their hand or get considered. Most of what happens is a lot of these senators appoint selection committees that vet candidates for them and make recommendations to them so that they in turn can recommend somebody to the White House. And if you look at the composition of these selection committees, who does it tend to be? People that donate to their campaigns that are themselves corporate lawyers and former prosecutors. So it's no surprise that the types of people that end up getting nominated are the professional colleagues of the people that serve on these selection committees. And so they come from the same lines of work. What we are trying to do is sort of put a microscope on these selection committees. Only about half of the senators even disclose who's on them. The rest of them keep the process entirely opaque and don't acknowledge who are the members of those committees. We're launching pressure campaigns to try to force Democrats that don't disclose who's on their membership committees to do so. And in the cases where they do disclose it, highlighting the lack of proportionality in terms of the types of people that are on there. And our ideal solution would be that a Joe Biden would come in and completely just end this practice of so excessively deferring to senators to come up with recommendations for these positions. If you look back to the 1970s, Jimmy Carter created independent presidential level commissions so that people could nominate or suggest names to him that he would then in turn nominate. He tried to, you know, take it a little bit out of the Senate. You have so much patronage and donor back scratching that happens when it's all going through the pipeline controlled by the senators, that it's just rife with abuse and cronyism. But in the meantime, we would at least like to blow up and make a huge liability out of the tilted composition of these selection committees. There's a bunch of groups on the left that have been, including ourselves, that have been collecting names for the last couple of years. And the Biden Transition Project is already stood up. So even though the campaign is still being carried out, there is a taxpayer-funded transition project that exists, that is fully staffed, that includes people that are vetting potential judicial candidates. We're making recommendations to them. And the people that we are putting our muscle behind are people that are younger and people that come from those diverse professional backgrounds. And there's reason to believe that the Biden administration is going to have an improved outlook on this question. In the platform that was adopted at the virtual convention this past summer, there was explicit language calling for priority status to be assigned to public defenders, labor lawyers, civil rights lawyers. That was specifically contemplated in the platform. And according to the reports that are out this week from Bloomberg News, among others, the leading candidate to be Joe Biden's chief of staff is a guy named Ron Klain, who is known to a lot of people in the judicial issue space because he's a former, he was the Sherpa for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, working in the White House counsel's office under President Clinton when RBG was nominated. He's a long time involved in American Constitution Society, one of the big progressive legal groups. And Ron gets this as well as anybody in terms of the need to skew younger and to diversify the federal bench. So I think in Ron Klain, we'll have a partner inside the Biden White House in terms of making this a priority.
You know, we just have a couple minutes here, but the ACS is an organization that Russ Feingold now, I think, is the president of. I think that's the title he has. And it was, in many respects, at least contemplated as some type of a ballast against the Federalist Society. But it feels like during the Obama administration that the ACS, it never got liftoff. And in some ways it became, I mean, with the Federalist Society, that's the only imprimatur you need if you're on the right. And and it creates a, almost like a, some type of corporate structure where you move up the ranks in there and people sort of, there's cranes in there and they lift you and it gets you in front of the right people. The ACS never really achieved that. And maybe, you know, maybe under Feingold on some level, it will, like that imprimatur will mean something. But let me, when you talk about just, and this may seem a little remedial, but when you talk about like sort of like outside pressure, like this stuff you that you're talking about in terms of pressuring this stuff and groups aligning and whatnot, the general public's not really aware of it that much. I mean, I guess if they dig into, like, I don't know, they stumble on some deep Axios or Politico thing or something. But what does that actually mean? Like, how does that work? You've worked in all these different capacities. Like, why does that work, or how does it?
So one silver lining for people that get frustrated by, you know, what can sometimes come off as the passive effort that is made by Democrats in all these fights, is I sort of saw firsthand during my time in the Senate and believe this to be true now, now that I'm running Demand Justice. Democrats more so than Republicans, are actually quite sensitive to public pressure. Republicans are often incorrigible and beyond shaming. And you can have something like the blockade against Merrick Garland that consistently polls very poorly. And they will just sort of rally around the flag and they'll, you know, look at how unpopular it is to get rid of the ACA, and yet they're still conducting this litigation that is going to be argued before the Supreme Court right after the election. And so they keep their heads down and they sort of wall themselves up and become immune to public pressure. And they sort of, they have a way of sort of making the politics come around to them because they're just so stubbornly plowing forward that it normalizes any position that they take because there's so much consistency in, across their party. On our side, our folks tend to get spooked. They get spooked by Republican colleagues thinking poorly of them, which contributes to this sort of passivity or, you know, desire to work across the aisle, even if it's completely one-sided, the cooperation. But they also are responsive to public pressure when it comes from a grassroots level. So calls in their offices, when I worked for Senator Schumer, this was one of the great insights of Indivisible when it first got launched in 2017. It was that calls matter. And show up at town halls, and that matters. And they were absolutely right. When I worked for Schumer for 6 years, when he would return after floor votes back to his office, the first thing he wanted to see on his desk, you know, at usually the last vote was at like 6 o'clock or 6:30. So he'd get back to his desk around 7 p.m. And before he would start some of his evening review of like white papers and memos that had been prepared for him for the staff, the first thing he always wanted to have on his desk was a call sheet of the calls that had come in to all the field, all his in-state offices and the DC office. He wanted them, he wanted the bottom line figure of how many calls had come in, and then he wanted it broken out by issue. And that was something that then would be the basis of the first 10 or 15 minutes of conversation with the staff about why was, you know, all of a sudden calls are up on this issue. Maybe we should speak out on it. So they are wired to want to be responsive to public pressure and bad press. And so a lot of this stuff, you're right, it might be unseen by the general public because in the initial instance, it might just be a Politico story, or it might just be a Washington Post blog item, or it might just be an op-ed that runs on the Data for Progress website that Sean McElwee runs. But these things are seen by senators. And so, yes, it's earned media tactics. It is, in some cases, we do paid media in Democratic home states about those senators. Like, we've done digital ads in Delaware about Chris Coons when he was consistently voting for Donald Trump's judicial appointees. And I think it, you know, Coons' posture towards Trump's judicial nominees has changed the last couple of years. It is in-state actions. So we have a lot of partner organizations that are on the ground that do sort of visits to senators' offices to drop off petitions, drop off letters, in some cases do sit-ins or demonstrations with signs outside the office. We drive calls to offices. So we ask our members from time to time to do calls to action where we ask them to literally phone their offices and complain about, you know, an individual judicial nominee that a Democrat oughtn't be voting for but is, just so that we can then get into that daily tally that the senators are reading at the end of the day. So they are responsive to grassroots tactics and earned media tactics, paid media tactics, but it needs to be consistent. It needs to grow in size and scope over time. So it can't remain static. You need to show that something is catching on. So, but yes, in general, I believe in that all that does work.
Ryan Fallon, Executive Director of Demand Justice. Thanks so much for your time today. Really interesting stuff. And I imagine we'll hear more and love to have you back soon.
Yeah, and I want to say, when we did air that ad that you mentioned on the podcast, you said some very kind words about our organization in and around reading the ad script. So I did hear that and I appreciate it.
Oh, all right. Well, all right. Thanks, Brian Fallon. All right, folks, we're going to take just a 15-second break. We'll be back in just a moment. Brian Fallon had mentioned this briefly, but Amy Coney Barrett's support has gone up amongst Democrats and independents. It is actually at 51% of voters now back Barrett's confirmation, the most ever support, this is according to a Morning Consult poll, for a Trump Supreme Court nominee. I don't know if there is a better measure for the failure of at least some of those Democrats on the Judiciary Committee than that number right there. I mean, I just don't like what else, what other evidence do you need that they're not doing it right? This is a judge who is going to launch a frontal attack on a woman's sovereignty over her own body. This is a judge who sat on as a trustee for a school for, I think, 3 years, one that banned children whose parents were gay, that basically discouraged, at the very least, LGBTQ teachers. And this is not like 30 years ago. This is from like 2015 to 2018. They simply, the strategy here was to just lay low, not make any waves. And it was a failed strategy by any measure. And even to the extent that, they're looking just for the election, because, you know, to have a Supreme Court justice that's nominated that over 51% of the people think is okay, that reflects well on Donald Trump. And that's not what you would imagine a political party challenging the sitting president would want to do. But we will be talking more about this as the week goes on. We are 2 weeks out from the election. We'll see you soon. All right. That is the end of our first hour. We're going to move into our fun half of our program. Just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. Become a member. Join the Majority Report. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. I just got a text that Sarah Silverman's telling stories again. we'll talk about that maybe in the fun half. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. And also, don't forget the AM Quickie. 7 minutes of headlines in your on your podcast, audio podcast machine, or you can watch it on YouTube at our Majority Report Audio, youtube.com, Majority Report Audio or Majority Report Live, I think it is. Majority Report Live. I should probably get that down by now. And also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And check out Nomi's show at 3 p.m. today, youtube.com/TheNomiKey Show. I'm getting that right. It's actually the G-N-O-M-E is really it's so bad.
I really think the employee thing was all it took. Employee Nomi Key.
Oh, no, it was the Nomi, the G-N-O-M-E. Nomi Key. Okay. Did it for me. I don't know why. I don't know why that did it. And, you know, we won't even talk about that. But so check that out today at 3 p.m. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Hey, so this week on the Antifada, are my levels okay? I feel like I always get the levels wrong.
Pretty good.
You're good.
Like a little, I can't tell.
I will be.
Go ahead.
This week on the Antifada, I will be confused about the levels. No, we had back our friend Pavlos Roufos, a very smart, very interesting Greek communist friend of ours who's currently in Munich to talk about a little update on the situation in Greece. The far right party, the Golden Dawn, was just outlawed, which was a major victory for anti-fascists everywhere. We talk a little bit about the relationship between the far right and the center right, where right-wing radicalization comes from and how people in Europe are viewing the U.S. In light of COVID. So check that out. That's up now. Patreon.com/theAntifada.
My guess is not well in terms of the Europeans looking at Americans at this point.
Yeah, not so good.
I would imagine they're not terribly impressed. Matt.
Last night we had Joshua Kahn Russell on. We went deep into Bolivia in both the main show and the post game. We also talk about the Mi'kmaq versus commercial fishermen, who the commercial fishermen, just to put a quantitative number towards like their way they're attacking these indigenous fishermen, they're upset that the indigenous people have set up 500 traps and the commercial industry there sets up 900,000. So they decided to burn down some lobster buildings because the indigenous people are setting 500 traps. What was that?
Buildings?
Yeah, they burned down a building that was storing lobsters and poured like paint thinner into the lobster stuff. It's crazy. So we talked about that at patreon.com/TMBS and the Microbook Show on YouTube.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
And for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ the Anarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych.
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. Africans. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.